And you could just face me and we're just going to talk, all right? Welcome to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. I am Jose Candelario here with Ray Boy, returning citizen, but now on another level, on the next level with the empowerment program. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, brother. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. So tell me, where did you grow up?
I grew up here in the city of New Haven. I'm born and raised in New Haven. I grew up in the Hill section, Congress Avenue area. You know?
Now tell me a bit about growing up, with your brothers and
family. You know, growing up, I mean, it's normal for, you know, the average kid in the hood and being born in the 70s and, you know, early 80s growing up. I'm one of nine. You know, I got six brothers and three sisters. So, you know, you only imagine what that's like for a household. You know, my mom, you know, community person, you know, we had countless cousins and, you know, friends stay over all the time. So my house was always full, you know, always full.
Your mom is a community person, you say. What kind of values do you get from her?
Man. The one value that stood out to me that my mom always gave me was about respect. My mom told me that respect could get you anything you want in this world. You don't got to have money. You don't got to have nothing. You just got to have respect. You know, and I've always held that dear to me. And she told me this at a very young age. You know, so knowing people is to respect people. And whatever comes from that, me giving that respect, I'm just humbled to receive it.
Any good stories about your mom, seeing her struggle, doing the best she can for you?
Oh, yeah. It just wasn't for me. My mom did what she could do for all her kids to the best of her ability. Every day was a struggle for us, you know, having six boys and three girls, you know, all various different ages. And being in the hood, as we would say. So, you know, you can only think about what that struggle is. I look back at it now and say that I took a lot of what my mom was doing for granted. And that's like getting into the streets. I felt as though what my mom was giving me at that time wasn't enough, but it was actually enough. I just felt that it wasn't enough. So that's what led me to the streets, because I wanted more than what my mom was giving me. And my mom was definitely making sure that we were okay and taken care of. And we went to bed with food in our stomachs. And, you know, we woke up to a decent breakfast to send us off to school. And, you know, we dressed well and we was always clean and things of that nature.
Wow. In hindsight, right? You got into the streets at an early age, or how was... other was that process?
I mean, the introduction is similar, and it's like the story is no different no matter where you go geographically. It's like coming off the front porch and is what you see in the community. You know, the older guys you look up to in the community. My sister's boyfriend at the time was very lucrative in the illicit activities in the city of New Haven. Friends of my older brother and my older sisters, you know, was involved in activity, and just guys I knew growing up. And once you come out, you know, you go into the store, then you hanging around, and then it's like, I'm old enough to do this. Like, you know, give me my shot. And I took that shot at around 12 or 13, and, you know, it changed the course of my life for the rest of my life.
What can you say for a young man now, because they say that now there's more opportunities, as I've spoken to other people, versus at your time?
I think the difference between now and my time is guys are coming home with lived experience after terms of incarceration, and they're sharing that lived experience. Prior to, going to prison was like a badge of honor. You know, when coming home, whether you work out or you be business minded, but that was like a badge of honor. But now you have guys who have lived this experience and are coming home. It's like, hold up, pump your brakes. You don't have to go through what I went through. You can learn from my experience. Just listen. So I think that's the difference between then and now.
So were you in the lifestyle to improve your status or to improve your financial situation?
I mean, we all get into it. I got into it because, like I said, I wanted that extra pair of sneakers. Mm-hmm. But my mom's had already bought me two pair to start school with. And she bought those two pair for not just me. She bought two pair for all of her kids. You know what I'm saying? So you can imagine what that was like at that time. So I just wanted the extra pair or two that I could bring in with the finances that I got from hustling. And then as I wanted the extra outfit, back then we had Macy's, we had Edward Malley's, you know, different stores. We had Caesars, you know, when Edward Malley's left and Happy Vendor, all of these different things. You want the thick laces in your sneakers and all these different things that you see that you don't have in the house you want. And you know that those are things that your mom's not going to waste her money on because she's making sure you have the bare necessities, you know, to get to in school and look right. So when I started getting into the streets around 12 or 13, though, that was my intent, you know, to have lunch money for when I went to school. I didn't really have to eat the lunch. I could get the fruit roll-ups and the oatmeal chip, the oatmeal cookies or the chocolate chips, whatever my choice was. You know, I ain't have to eat drink the white milk. I could get chocolate milk and pay the quarter for it. You know, little things like that meant something to me at that time. And that's why I got into it. But as I got into it, nobody ever told me everything else that came with it. You know, the violence, you know, protecting your territory, the potential that you might go to prison for the rest of your life. You know, the potential that you might go to prison, period. So when you're getting involved in the streets, like, nobody's really giving you the blueprint on everything that you should be looking for. Everybody's like, they'll tell you about the money, the clothes, and the women. But that's where it stop at. They're not telling you that as you get older, you may be beefing over some of these women. You know, as you get a car, you may be beefing over some of the fact that somebody scratched your car. And you may kill somebody and you may end up in prison for, you know, 30 years like I did.
So you're incarcerated, you're spending time. What evolution took place while during those years?
Well, there's really no switch for the turn off for a criminal way of thinking. It came with years of maturation, years of introspection. When I first went to prison in the early 90s, gangs was at an all-time high in the Connecticut prison system. You know, I got involved with gangs and gang violence. And through maturation, I saw that that itself was a fallacy. You know, we go to prison, and once we join these different entities under the auspices that we family, because we refer to each other as brother, but yet and still these are the same people that when we come home, we won't even invite to our house to have dinner with our family at the kitchen table. You know what I'm saying? So that should say what type of brother it is. And a lot of times people don't share the same interests. Prison is a very predatory environment. And I don't mean that it's predatory where people are preyed upon for their weakness. It's also predatory where individuals are preyed upon for the things that they can do, the acts of violence that they can display against one another under that gang culture. So you see brothers coming to prison that wasn't involved with a gang. Next thing you know, they're involved with a gang and their reputation has exploded because the acts of violence that they displayed. But yet, and still, those acts of violence are predicated upon the fact that this person put himself in a situation that he probably no longer wants to be in. But now the first law of nature kicking in is self-preservation. It's like, yo, how do I survive when there's nowhere to run? There's nowhere to hide, but I'm confined for 20 years, 25 years.
You got youth out there you have youth out there making ill-advised decisions nowadays. The streets are still lucrative, but is there really any financial gain left in that?
There isn't. And I've watched the streets from a distance while I was incarcerated, and then some individuals that I associated with in prison have chosen to still go that route after prison. And I have talked to them since I've been home and had intimate conversations with them about the choices that they make in life and they've been making, and the risk versus reward. Like, how many times are you going to take, put your life at risk, you know? And some of these guys are still doing the same thing with their finances. You know, they're still buying a good car, a nice car, but they still live in, you know, in a Section 8 apartment. They're still living with their mothers. And I think that's because if they had a job, or if they were shown that, yo, you can get a job, you can still have that car, you can own a home. I think what brothers need nowadays, not so much mentors coming home, they need life coaches, because they don't have their life in order. And I think, like, a lot of people are looking at me like, yo, you came home and your transition has been different from others. But I think it's what I put into the work I put into myself, as well as the people that I surround myself with. My people ain't going to allow me to see myself fail, and I'm not going to allow myself to see them fail. So every day when people are not looking, and what people can't see is the ones that are pulling me up by my bootstraps, the ones that are helping me tighten my strings, you know, when they see something that may be loose, and they're not afraid to tell me that. And I'm not afraid to tell them that. But that's a real relationship. That's a real brotherhood. That's something that I honor amongst my peers, as well as my wife.
You're open to receive the criticism. How tough is that of a transition? Because you seem to be a very knowledgeable young man.
Yeah, well, with receiving criticism, one, a lot of people say it's constructive, right? So you have to think about what can come out of this, right? And if something is constructive, you're the foundation of what they're trying to build upon, right? So if someone sees me in the manner that they see me, right, you can't destruct what I've already built. You can only add on and enhance what I already built. So if the house is built and you feel as though the house need a patio, right, we build a patio, and we go through the proper process of building the patio, meaning that we go to the city, we get our permits, and what we build, right, adds more equity into the house. So I'm open and I'm receptive to constructive criticism. And the one thing that I am is I'm not afraid to admit when I'm wrong. Because it's only, I know and understand my cup ain't half empty, it ain't half full. It's only a drop of water when it comes to knowledge that's in my cup. And knowledge is infinite. And if knowledge is infinite, you have to be able to receive knowledge wherever it comes from. I don't have to follow you to per se to receive the knowledge that you possess. And I think a lot of times we get caught up in the man versus the message. Look at what's going on now. We look at Shay Shay, and we look at all these different things. Like, people mad about what Steve Harvey said. People mad about what Cat Williams said. People mad about what Charleston White said. But a lot of what Charleston White says is actual facts. But you get caught up in the man that he's telling, and he's doing all of this, which he's telling you he's going to do, and you miss the message. And the message is what we should be applying to our lives, because it adds equity to our life.
You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. I'm Jose Candelario here with Ray Boy, going through the mental transitions and the reframing, as they say, in our perspectives in life. So you have worked on yourself. What are the more fundamental changes that laid that foundation?
One of the changes for me was receiving 50 years. And I was tried and convicted as an adult for a crime that I committed at the age of 17. And once 50 years became my reality, I was a seventh grade dropout. I was reading on the third or fourth grade level at the time I entered the penitentiary. And the world that I entered was different from the world that I exist in. So I'm just a boy striving to be a man and being thrust into this environment that's uncivilized, right? And it requires you to mature a lot faster than you were on the street. Because remember, I told you it's a predatory environment. That's all prison is. and people will pray on you, whether it's for a soup, it's for a colored pen or a colored pencil, whatever they feel as though they can get away with, people will test you. And but once 50 years became my reality, I knew that I wanted to come home a better person than I was when I went in. Not only that, I knew that I owe my family and loved ones a return on the time that they was invested in me, the money that they was invested in me. People don't do that, don't assist you and take care of you while you're in prison for you to come home and be the same person. I think the people that are supportive of you while you're incarcerated know who you are by nature, as opposed to the situations and circumstances that evolved out of your life, that has evolved in your life to where they saying, you know what? I know who Ray is. And I know that if I can support him, he'll come home a different person. He'll be that person he was before he was tainted by the streets. My mother was like, he'll be that innocent child. My mother just wanted her child back when she lost me to the streets. Now my mother has her child back. And my mother's happy, like, yo, look at what my child is doing. Look at what my child is, how far he's come.
Did you learn how to read or continue your education and whatnot?
I taught myself how to read while I was in prison. It's about prison is also about when you have these deficiencies, you have to be able to be vulnerable and speak to people about them. That's the only way it's going to change. So at that time, I was very fearful because I was egotistical. And I wouldn't let people see these different sides of me or these inadequacies in me. So what I did is I felt as though, okay, you don't want people to see it. You got to fix it. And what I did was I had an aunt who's a retired lieutenant colonel in the United States Army who has no children. I'm like her child on my father's side. I'm the oldest grandchild. And she was completely supportive of everything that I did while I was incarcerated. I've never asked my aunt the whole time that I was incarcerated to send me money. I only asked her to send me books. And there was times where too much time passed and I didn't ask her to send me books. She would send me a card telling me, where's my next book order? And why hasn't it arrived at her house yet? So she contributed to the years of growth and development without even knowing. And she doesn't probably even, I never expressed the impact that she's had on my life because she did this continuously. She's never said, yo, I can't do that. She said, okay, give me a week. Let me get paid or I'll order that first thing in the beginning of the month. It was always a time when things would be ordered. It was never a no. And then I would read the books and I would talk to her about it. I would write about it. And she would see that it was helping me. Then I went back to school, got my GED. When I had finances, I would take, correspondence courses. Programs are hard for lifers to get into while in prison because they feel as though the people that need the programs are the ones that are going home sooner than later. So I found a way through cooking in the kitchen to get counselors that were running programs to get me on the list of programs. I'm good at baking. I would bake cakes and say, you need to get graduation class, need a cake. I got you. I got cakes and cookies, but I need to get in that domestic violence program. Or I need to get in that AVP program. Or I need to get in the Voices program. Because when we're dealing with reality, we're dealing with things that's real. Mm. And the reality was that my situation had two things that could come out of my situation. It could get worse or it can get better. And I didn't want it to get worse. Because I had love and support. So I wanted it to get better. So I did everything in my power to make it better. Not just for me, but for my community. So a lot of brothers looked up to me while I was serving time. And the knowledge that I had, I would impart to them. And the knowledge that they had, they would impart to me. And that's how we deal with equality. It says that each one teach one according to the knowledge that you possess.
Wow. You're listening to the Electric Drum here on 94.3 WYBC, The Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario, captivated with this conversation with Ray Boyd. How did you find a way out, or what was the process like to come home?
It was difficult coming home, because there's some of my family in prison. You're only allowed to have 7 adults on your visiting list. I got 6 brothers, 3 sisters, a mother, a wife, friends, family. So you think about the disconnect that prison caused and the collateral consequences of your actions. How many lives was affected by me being removed from the streets? And how my life was affected by losing complete contact with everybody that I knew outside of my immediate family and those that were supportive of me. So now it's like I've been away 50 years and I'm coming home. Remember, my reign in the street was from 12 or 13 to 19 when I became incarcerated. So now I'm coming home to so-called friends and so-called individuals that say they had love for me, but weren't around in 30 years. We don't know each other no more. There's a disconnect. Of course, I'm gonna say hi to you and I'm gonna respect you, but the individuals that I love and care for are the individuals that I just spent 3 decades with. So a lot of times when you see me out today, you'll see me amongst somebody that I probably spent a quarter of a century with in prison because they like-minded. And I think that a lot of the individuals that I was running the streets with or associated in the streets with haven't developed because they haven't been removed from the streets. And that's not to say that brothers in the streets are dumb or they ain't doing what they're supposed to be doing. Some of them ain't doing what they're supposed to be doing. Some of them still on the corners where we used to hang out at. It's a sad reality, but I see it, I witness it. I still got to go back to the community and see my mother. I still got to go back to the community and see my brothers and sisters because they still reside in my community. But I'm saddened by what I see when I return to my community. And I'm like, yo, if I did 30 years and I came home, things have gotten worse. I remember before I went in, we used to be like, who's going to be the next alcoholic that stands in front of the store all day and asks you for a dollar when you come out? I'm witnessing close pairs that I grew up with do that now. But I'm offering them help at the same time because I love my community. I love where I come from. Not only that, I know the potential in some of these dudes if they get help. But they got to want it more than I want it. But I'm letting them know I'm there. I'm letting the city know I'm here. When we're dealing with, like, that's what brought about Next Level Empowerment.
But before we get to that, how do you go from 50 to 30?
So from 50 to 30, I had acquired over 14 and a half years good time while I was incarcerated as a juvenile lifer. However, the state did not want me to utilize my good time towards my early release.
Why is that?
It's a, so let me take you back. In 2012, there was a United States Supreme Court case called Miller versus the State of Alabama. World-renowned attorney Brian Stevenson, he has the movie Just Mercy. There's a young brother named Evan Miller who was charged with murder at the age of 14 and sentenced to life without the possibility of parole and put in an adult prison system. And he challenged Evan Miller's case, and in 2012, the United States Supreme Court made it unconstitutional to sentence juveniles as lifers, to try and convict them as lifers and put them in adult prison systems for crimes they committed under the age of 18. Over the years, that age has risen because at the time, Brian Stevenson only asked the United States Supreme Court to look at the age of 18. Now, the brain science has always told us that the brain doesn't develop out of maturity until mid-20s, which is 25. So with that, Connecticut had to either change their laws or resentence all of the individuals that they tried as and convicted as adults, dating back to up until that time when the United States Supreme Court made the ruling, which was June 25th of 2012. And when they did so, you were supposed to look at, they, in 2015, they made parole eligibility for those that were under 18 when they committed their crimes. And murder in the state of Connecticut didn't have any parole eligibility at this time. So when they didn't want to allow me to use my good time, I went before a sentence modification judge, showed them the work that I was doing in prison. I had already co-founded two programs while in prison, the Skills of Socialization program, as well as True Reentry program, which got national recognition on 60 Minutes several years ago during the NCAA tournament. And once that happened, the federal judge granted me a sentence modification, which made me immediately eligible for parole. They still try to make me wait and get some more time out of me and not give me parole.
Wow. So you're fighting your way out.
I've been fighting my way out since the day I went in. So, but yeah, I'm fighting my way out.
But now there's laws, there resources to help you, and yet you still struggle.
I'm still struggling. Yeah. So even after I got the sentence modification, the judge made me immediately eligible for parole hearing. They wanted to schedule my parole hearing 4 months after the hearing. So we had a little discussion with that, with the parole board at the time. And we settled for the date because they said that they only do juvenile parole hearings at a certain time. So we settled for that date. I went before the parole board and unanimously they decided that I should be released. Even with the release of that date, they try to push the date back even further. So we went back to them and said, look, we already waited the time that you wanted us to wait for the juvenile parole hearing. The judge has ruled that he should be released immediately. You guys have already done the risk assessments and everything and granted him parole. Why isn't he out? They wanted me to wait longer, but they conceded afterwards and then said, let's get him out within a week. And I was released the following week.
You're out now. And what are the immediate challenges you face? Because reentry is not, things have changed now.
Things has changed drastically with reentry. Like I said, my mom's is a community person. Warren Kimbrough, she worked closely with him growing up. She worked closely with several other agencies in the community, like Project Moore. What I've seen coming home, I came home and I couldn't even get public assistance to help me with welfare. And I was only trying to be a contributing factor in my home until I became gainfully employed. But I got denied that right. And I'm like, I pleaded with them. I'm like, I just did 30 years. Like, I don't have no job experience. I've never been on the clock for anybody in my life. But I need to be able to bring something home now because as a man, I'm not in prison no more. So no one's obligated to take care of me anymore. No one's obligated to make sure that I have food, clothing, or shelter. That's my job. And I got denied, and fortunately, a friend of mine who owns a real estate service in West Hartford, he gave me employment the following week. So I was driving from New Haven to West Hartford every day for 6 months. And then I became employed at Yale New Haven Hospital for about 4.5-5 months with patient transportation. And now I'm currently at Yale Law School as a program manager for New Visions for Public Safety for the Racial Justice Center.
Your growth has been remarkable. Thank you so much for sharing. What is this new position you have at Yale, and what's your impact on your community now?
So the new position that I have at Yale is fairly new. The program is new. It's under the tutelage of Professor James Foreman and Kayla Vincent and my other colleague, Ariane Lewis. We do some great works. You know, we put on several symposiums last year. You know, we got some things coming up this year that we're working on, you know, community law libraries and things of that nature. I oversee the Books to Prison Project, where every month I take at least, you know, 10 to 15 cases of books that are donated to our organization to a correctional facility. And we get law books from the law school. And we have it in our budget to order books for individuals that are incarcerated. If they have loved ones that would like for their, you know, loved one to receive a book, they can go online to the Racial Justice Center and put the information in there, what book you would like them to receive. We strive to send all books, but through my personal experience, I would say that if you have a loved one that is incarcerated and you would like for that loved one to read a book, have them read something that's going to benefit them. You know, I read a story by Marcus Garvey before while I was incarcerated by Tony Martin. Marcus Garvey said, if you read one book a week, that's 52 books in a year. In 5 years, you read 260 books as opposed to a person who hasn't read one in that time. There's a lot of brothers that are wasting time in prison. They don't read books. They like Maury. They like Jerry. And then, you know, the gossip. So I challenged myself while I was incarcerated. Once I read that for like 2 years, and I was knocking out a book a week. And I was doing that. If the book was 300 pages or 350 pages, hypothetically, that's 50 pages a day. I got 24 hours a day while I'm incarcerated to read 50 pages a day.
So there are things that people can do on the outside to help someone get further along.
Most definitely. The importance is, like, with the job is we have neighbors of justice. Like, everybody that's incarcerated just blocked from here in Whaley Avenue are your neighbors. You have to ask yourself what type of neighbors you want coming home. You want a neighbor that's living next door to you where you got your lawnmower and your leaf blower in your yard, and when they come home, it's still there? Or you want the neighbor that's going to jump the fence and take your lawnmower and your leaf blower and go sell it to somebody down the street because they have problems that went unaddressed, but you could have always contributed to it.
So you can donate books, you can donate time.
You can donate books, you can donate time. I mean, we've all been impacted by someone that's incarcerated, whether it be addiction to the street life, because that's an addiction as well. You know what I'm saying? And we don't look at it like that. We look at addiction as we want to see somebody in the worst situation they could possibly be in and say that person strung out or that person addicted or that person's a fiend. But we have individuals that are addicted to a lifestyle and a culture that goes unaddressed. And to that person is sentenced, or we see the FBI come in and wrap all of these young brothers up and send them up to the penitentiary for 20, 30, 40 years, and we wait till they catch X amount of bodies to want to push them away and get rid of them in society when we could be working with them now on a preventative level.
I want to touch on something. You're saying things that you consume, right? What you consume dictates who you are.
Definitely.
Has music for you, listening to music, changed? I mean, do you listen more to, you know, what kind of tunes do you listen to now versus then?
Well, I was always taught that you could tell the mind of the people by the music that they listen to, right? A lot of bad choices and decisions that we make, right, are not necessarily coming out of something that has a beat behind it, but it's coming out of someone's lips, right? And when we say that, we use a term in the hood, like, you feel me? And the reason why we ask people, you feel me, a lot of people don't know what's the esoteric science behind it, is that we're talking about a drum, right? So as we're talking, what I'm saying is resonating to you because of the beat, right? And that beat is saying, okay, are you in tune with what he's saying? Or are you not in tune with it, right? So don't think that it's the hip hop or the R&B that's making somebody be some certain type of way in the bed. Think about the conversations that you're having and what type of conversation, what type of information are you taking in? Because you can read a good book or you can listen to a love song, but if things are toxic in the home, and that's the beat that you dance into, you're in a toxic environment. You got to leave. I listen to music every day. But I know how to balance what I'm listening to. I know how to take what I'm listening to, and I don't take it out of context. Yeah, I listen to Lil Durk. But I listen to Lil Durk, so when I'm having conversations with individuals, I could talk to them about a Lil Durk song. And Durk comes out of the drill world, right? So we talking about violence. How am I going to talk to you about violence and I ain't in tune with what you're listening to? Or I'm not in tune with you. Because a lot of our youth are bringing us a message saying, yo, listen to me. You can't hear what I'm trying to say? This is what's going on in my life. But you think because you're older than them, you can tell them what's going on in their life without listening to them. Because you've been through a similar situation. You ain't been through their situation. But you've been through a similar situation, so you don't need to hear what they have to say. But we yet and still we say, yo, that's our future. If you ain't listening to the future, you don't know what's going to happen. You ain't going to have foresight.
Thank you so much for sharing your story, your perspective. I could tell you were very well read. It's Thank amazing. You. Next Level Empowerment Program, how did we get in touch?
Next Level Empowerment Program, we have a website. Next, all one word. nextlevelemp.org. We have the merch there. We have all our events there. We have everything that we're about there. You can see our board members there. You'll see a lot of formerly incarcerated because I'm a strong knower that I don't believe because belief is subject to change in the presence of a higher knowledge. I know that the individuals that we have in place are the ones that are closer to solution based. And the individuals that created the problem. So I know we're going to get some things done in the city, and we're looking to branch out statewide. We have a warm line. Our warm line information is there on our website. I would love for everyone to tune in. The Sober House is going to be for in honor of Vincent Moore, you know, who was a mentor of mine while I was incarcerated. He ran the mentors group. He ran the lifers group. He's a contributing factor to why most of the men that were in Cheshire are free now because of the work that he's done with them, the work that we've done trying to change other men's lives while we're incarcerated. And unfortunately, this brother lost his life too soon. But I feel as though this is a way for us that came under his leadership to continue to lead and be effective in our community.
What's the name of the website?
The website is nextlevelemp.org.
All right. For more information, please reach out to Ray Boyd and his associates now in the streets doing a positive thing. Big Thank changes you. In New Haven. So I appreciate you and your time.
Thank you, brother.
This has been the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario. And like always, thank you for your listen.
Thank you.